good evening. This is Read Me Something You Love. And it's a Wednesday evening. And I'm sitting here in Camden Arts Centre, just off Finchley Road, which you'll be hearing every time someone opens the door. You'll be hearing the whir of traffic outside. And sitting here with Gus Ginsberg. I'm sure people have said this to you before. It's like a name of a poet or a saxophonist, sort of bebop.
Sure. I am actually related to the poet Allen Ginsberg in this case. Yeah.
What's the relation?
I'd have to ask my uncle Jeff exactly what it is. I think the Ginsbergs who bore him were cousins of my grandfather. Yeah. But I'd have to ask my uncle Jeff to be sure.
Yeah, because when I was thinking about your name, as I occasionally do, I was thinking, well, you know, if you're going to be a Ginsberg, of course, Allen Ginsberg is for me the cool, you know, ultra cool Ginsberg. But Gus, pretty much is up there.
I stole the name from my dog, actually. The sorts of things I write, at least while I still have to have a day job, I have to be careful who reads them, I suppose.
Right. So your academic, I should just say that Gus is, would you say the day job is academia, predominantly? Would you put it in that category?
A combination of academic, clerical.
So the academic and clerical work you do under a different name.
That's absolutely correct. Well, I mean, the very first story I published was an excerpt of a novel, but it was a sex scene from the novel. Basically, I subscribe to Duotropes, which is a listserv of all these different publishing vehicles and opportunities, and I saw there's this Canadian journal of literary erotica, so I sent them a sex scene from my novel, and they published it. So that's the first thing I published, and here I was working in academia and not wanting that to be read by the advisor or other professors or other graduate students. My first published work is in a Canadian journal called The Moose and Pussy. You might have to edit that out.
I'm going to go and hunt that down.
My second publication, and this is almost as weird, my second publication is a parody of my graduate school experience. And some of the characters are very thinly veiled professors from my graduate program, in which I literally demonize them. I set the story at the Demonological Seminary. The story was published in an anthology of humorous science fiction called Probing Uranus. The second word is spelled like the planet, not the body part. So two words, Probing Uranus. Contains my story. So, you know, with these sorts of publishing opportunities, it's best to go with a pen name, I think.
Yeah. Good. Well, we now know, and I'm sure their hits will be going up forthwith.
I sure hope so.
So, you're going to read for us on the You're going to read for us on the nutritional value of dreams. Now, I know for a fact that this is your favorite short story ever.
Indeed. It is one of the best stories ever written. Certainly my favorite that I've come across. On occasion, I sometimes think Ingeborg Bachmann's Undine Goes is my favorite, but most of the time on the nutritional value of dreams. And I suppose after the recording, or after the reading, I'll tell you a bit more why. I've got my own personal Gesternak that isn't nearly as benevolent as the one in this story.
Great. Well, shall we go straight into the reading? I'm really looking forward to this.
Sure, me too. Okay, let's read. On the Nutritional Value of Dreams by Edgar Caret. I woke up in the middle of the night, startled to find the Gesternak eating a dream I was having about you. Furious, I jumped out of bed and punched it in the nose as hard as I could, The Gesternach dropped what was left of the dream, but I didn't stop hitting it, even when it crawled under the bed and lost its shape. I kept punching that ungainly shadow. Finally, I stopped. Exhausted and sweaty, I gathered up the remnants of the dream. It didn't leave much, just the black sweatpants you were wearing, your effortless grin, and a certain contact between us. I don't know what kind. Maybe a hug. The Gesternach had eaten everything around it, leaving only that, naked. I was left sprawled on the floor, desolate and silent, in nothing but my boxers and a layer of sweat. Hours of patient sleep, waiting for the dream to come, and now, nothing. Worse than nothing. Just a single drop of the taste of a vanished ice pop dripping into my mouth. A faint whimper came from under the bed. It was the Gesternach. First, I thought it might be in pain. After all, I'd walloped the shadow. But there wasn't an ounce of pain in the sobs. I tasted the Gesternach's tears, which were flowing along the bedroom floor, and they were sweet on my tongue. The Gesternach was crying with joy, and its tears attested to the wonderful taste of the dream, which was making every bit of its non-existent body tremble. Its sobs told me about those long nights it had waited under the bed, empty, feeding only on fragments of my dreams. Nauseating dreams of boredom and apathy. It had no choice but to chew on slowly. Dreams of pain, loss, and fear it tried to destroy so I could sleep. Dreams that so often stuck painfully in its throat. Every night the Gesternach swallowed up hour after hour of indifference and suffering, leaving my sleep smooth and dark, and tonight it finally got its reward. Its painful hunger was satisfied, and for a while it had experienced the alternative to emptiness. Its body knew more than nothingness. It was almost sunrise, and my partner's shadow hand slid out from under the bed and pointed to the middle of the room, to the bits of the dream I still had left. Sweatpants, a smile, an intoxicating, elusive touch. And the fading fingers of the shadow seemed to be saying, "Here, my friend, there's some good left for you, too."
That's great, thank you.
You're welcome, thank you for the opportunity.
So, do you have an image of this Gesternach when you're reading?
Yes, it's a very amoeba-like. I guess you could call it a structure or a creature, shadowy, amoeba-like, shape-shifting. Obviously, it's got hands and fingers from the story,
and a nose.
And that's
interesting because he does say. It is the sort of shadowy amoeba-like substance, but it has a nose.
Right. We fill in, the thing is, there's not a lot of details in this story. We fill in a lot of the details ourselves. So you picture this big blob probably hunched over the remnants of a dream, gobbling, you know, using its shadowy hands and stuffing bits and pieces into its mouth. So it's got a mouth, a nose, presumably eyes. Doesn't have to, but I suppose it mirrors us somewhat.
What is this thing?
It's a dream eater. A dream destroyer. Well, it destroys the bad dreams and makes you forget them.
Mm.
We forget most of our dreams, from what I understand. Probably the only times you remember a dream is if you wake up before it's over.
Do you remember your dreams?
Most nights I don't, but sometimes I do. And I think I mentioned earlier I have my own personal Gesternach, and he's not nearly as benevolent as the one in this story. My Gesternach is perverse. My Gesternach lets the bad dreams play out long, almost to the end, before I wake up, and cuts off good ones early. To give you examples, I had a dream that I got dragged to the synagogue naked one Shabbat morning, and that damn Gesternach let the service go on and on. We got to the Elenu before... before I woke up, the Elena, which is near the end of the service. I mean, it was a terrible dream. I was freaking out because here I was in a synagogue, naked.
Did other people notice?
Yeah,
in the dream?
They were disdainful. Here's what I thought. I thought, okay, I've got a talis bag. I reached in the talis bag, but I have a pretty good sized talus. I mean,
can cover quite a bit.
Yeah. But however, this talus, my Masorti talus, it shrunk to a liberal talus, which didn't really cover very much. So it couldn't really cover anything. It just went around my neck. And I thought about positioning the yarmulke over my crotch, but I thought that would be obscene. You know, if I'm naked anyway, I might as well just cover the bald spot on the top of my head rather than the naughty bits. So here I was, and the other funny thing about the dream, I was in a liberal synagogue, and the melodies they were singing sounded very Anglican to me. They didn't sound like what I was accustomed to Jewish liturgy sounding like. And so under my breath, I was singing the tunes the way I knew them. But I was doing it very quietly because I was thinking in my dream, these people might be very offended if this man who shows up naked to their service dares to correct their customs.
So it was sort of the classic dream of shame, I suppose. Often those dreams, when we dream, we're kind of naked.
Well, sometimes, you know, if you're dreaming that you're in an orgy, then, you know.
Yeah, but your Geshtanach kind of cuts those off.
It does. I've had this recurring dream of my wife and I are standing outside of an orgy room, and we're discussing what we're going to allow each other to do, what we're okay with, what's our safe words,
this
all this sort of thing.
This sounds like a Kerrigan story.
It does. And every time the dream cuts off before we actually go in, because this little voice in my head says, this isn't real, this would never happen in a million years. And then I wake up thinking, damn.
Yeah. Doesn't the Geshtanach, though, because you were saying that yours is the opposite, but to begin with, isn't that what the Geshtanach in this story is essentially doing, in that he's having a dream, possibly even an erotic dream, and the Geshtanach is feasting off this,
mm-hmm.
and not really letting him enjoy it?
Exactly. I suppose that's a bit perverse of the other Geshtanach as well. It's a fascinating concept. I mean, the term itself, I think he derived it from German, Gesternacht, yesterday evening. And he's toying with the idea of your dreams disappearing when you wake up, as if the yesterday evening swallowed it up. Genius.
I was wondering, reading this story, is what is the before of this story? Because he talks about eating a dream I was having about you, and it got me thinking, well, who is the you, and what is his relationship, the character's relationship to that you?
Obviously, it's some sort of intimate relationship where a touch would be desirable, but you really can't tell, either from the English or the Hebrew version, whether it's a specific gender.
I might just say here that Gus actually brought with him the Hebrew copy of the book, and we've just actually done, before starting this one, we actually did the whole of the podcast in Hebrew, because of course our Hebrew, his Hebrew is flawless, my Hebrew is close to flawless, so we've
Excellent.
Just done it, which, so if it sounds a little bit jaded, some of the things we're saying is because we're kind of repeating ourselves here. Sorry, you were saying that in Hebrew it's
right, it's the same. You don't know the gender of the other. You sort of guess that the narrator's male because the narrator's wearing boxers. But other than that, no strong gender markers. It's a fairly minimalist story. Not a whole lot of details.
My feeling, I don't know if you've kind of come up with a kind of a backstory, but my feeling was that he's either been dumped, or he's been left, or he's divorced. He's having the dream of her, or of whoever the other person is, and the dream is so delicious because that person is no longer somehow in his life. Maybe this person has died.
Those are all excellent suppositions. Obviously, he's in his bed alone, so
yeah.
These are all plausible backstories.
Have you thought about? Have you kind of come up with a backstory for yourself, or do you, when you read the story, do you exist completely, as it were, in the present with the story?
I exist in the present with the story, completely.
But would there be that sadness? Because I feel a sadness in this story.
You know, that's a very excellent point. If it's just a partner away on a business trip, it's not going to be nearly as sad as a breakup or a death or...
I don't know if I'm reading too much into it necessarily, although, you know.
Well, why would he be so angry otherwise? I mean, if it's a dream about a woman he sees every other day, then woman or man, then it wouldn't be nearly so catastrophic that the gastronach was eating it.
Mm.
I think some of the dreams I treasure are about people who are no longer here. Every once in a while, I have a brother who's deceased, and every once in a while, I'll see him in a dream. And those are really sweet to me. Or our two previous dogs, when they appear in my dream, those are sweet, beautiful dreams to me.
Mm-hmm.
I woke up in the middle of the night, startled to find the gastronach eating a dream I was having about you. Furious, I jumped out of bed and punched it in the nose as hard as I could. The gastronach dropped what was left of the dream, but I didn't stop hitting it. Even when it crawled under the bed and lost its shape, I kept punching that ungainly shadow. Finally, I stopped. Exhausted and sweaty, I gathered up the remnants of the dream. It didn't leave much, just the black sweatpants you were wearing, your effortless grin, and a certain contact between us. I don't know what kind, maybe a hug. The gastronach had eaten everything around it, leaving only that, naked. I was left sprawled on the floor, desolate and silent, in nothing but my boxers and a layer of sweat. Hours of patient sleep, waiting for the dream to come. And now, nothing. Worse than nothing, just a single drop of a taste of a vanished ice pot dripping into my mouth.
He then goes on to say, he then sort of seems to suggest that actually this feeding, this consumption of dreams, is a good thing. Because, okay, so he's eating the good dreams, but he's also, you know, it's also good that we're maybe forgetting all of the gastronach he's eating, dreams that could potentially haunt us, you know, dreams of pain, loss, and fear. It tried to destroy, maybe didn't completely, tried to destroy so I could sleep.
I suppose in the narrator's dreams of the breakup or the parting or whatever traumatic event it was, there's probably the mundane dreams too that he would like to forget. I mean, who wants to dream about their everyday life? Who wants to dream about work? Those are some of the worst dreams you can have because you wake up and you feel like you've just been at work. So I do think that overall the gastronach is helpful in his story.
Mm.
Even if now and then it has to eat a good dream. And maybe it was eating the good dream to help him. Maybe it thought that this dream would traumatize him, dreaming of the one who's no longer there.
Mm. There is a kind of, a bittersweet happiness in those good dreams. I'm thinking of when you were talking about your deceased dogs and your brother. Lovely to dream that, but also there must be a sort of a sense also of sadness.
Indeed. And I do... It's a weird thing. When I have those dreams, I wake up very happy and sad at the same time, but happy to have seen them again, at least, you know, in the dream. So maybe that was his fight with the gastronach. Don't destroy these dreams. Even though there's a bit of sadness to them, they're beautiful to me.
Mm.
Don't take them away.
Mm.
A faint whimper came from under the bed. It was the gastronach. First, I thought it might be in pain. After all, I'd really walloped the shadow. But there wasn't an ounce of pain in the sobs. I tasted the gastronach's tears, which were flowing along the bedroom floor, and they were sweet on my tongue. The gastronach was crying with joy, and its tears attested to the wonderful taste of the dream, which was making every bit of its non-existent body tremble. Its sobs told me about those long nights it had waited under the bed, empty, feeding only on fragments of my dreams. Nauseating dreams of boredom and apathy, it had no choice but to chew on slowly. Dreams of pain, loss, and fear, it tried to destroy so I could sleep. Dreams that so often stuck painfully in its throat. Every night the gastronach swallowed hour after hour of indifference and suffering, leaving my sleep smooth and dark. And tonight, it finally got its reward. Its painful hunger was satisfied, and for a while, it had experienced the alternative to emptiness. Its body knew more than nothingness. It was almost sunrise, and my partner's shadow hand slid out from under the bed and pointed to the middle of the room, to the bits of the dream I still had left. Sweatpants, a smile, an intoxicating, elusive touch. And the fading fingers of the shadow seemed to be saying, "Here, my friend, there's some good left for you, too."
How do you read that ending? How do you read that last line? I know we talked a little bit about it, actually, before when we were doing the podcast in Hebrew. Because it's slightly different in Hebrew, isn't it? "Here, my friend, there's some good left for you, too," is in English.
The literal translation from the Hebrew would be, "Here, my friend, I've left some good for you, too." In the Hebrew, it's more active. "I've left it."
And personal, isn't it?
Right. They have a relationship, the two of them, the Geshtranach and the narrator. And this one, it almost seems dishonest. Or no, actually, the Hebrew, it seems more dishonest, to be honest. "I've left some good," but I mean, it seems perhaps the narrator should argue with him, saying, "No, if I didn't get up and punch you, you would have eaten all of it."
He is incredibly angry, the narrator, isn't he?
He must have seen it before.
Uh-huh. So they've been through this rigmarole before.
Or a different version of it, but he knew it was there. He didn't seem at all... I mean, he was surprised, he was startled, but he wasn't... He knew what it was doing. Initially, if we had seen such a thing, we wouldn't know what it was doing exactly.
Would be where our fear would come. But he's not afraid of it at all.
No, bravely attacking it, punching it on the nose.
So there's a sense almost that, I don't know, that it's sort of a part of him in a way?
Sure. I mean, I think it's metaphorical for the subconscious or for different parts of himself that destroy memories or feed on memories or dreams.
I feel quite sorry for the Geshtanach, you know, towards the end of that story, particularly that line... It had experienced the alternative to emptiness.
Yeah, it's astounding. You do feel sorry for it. It's really doing him a favor. It's really helping him out.
And he's doing it a favor. And they're both kind of feeding off each other, aren't they?
Exactly.
He actually feeds off the Geshtanach's tears.
Indeed, and that was a strange thing. What did you think when you read that? I mean, who tastes other people's tears? That's probably the weirdest thing in the whole story.
I tasted the Geshtanach's tears, which were flowing along the bedroom floor, and they were sweet on my tongue. Are they sweet because the Geshtanach is crying with joy, or is there kind of a schadenfreude there, a sort of sense that he's actually almost enjoying, this part of him that's enjoying the Geshtanach's pain?
Right. I don't think it's a schadenfreude in this case. That line you just read... show that it was enjoying it, that it was the dreams are nourishing it somehow.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that really jumped out at me when you were reading it was that word "naked" in the line, "The Geshtanach had eaten everything around it, leaving only that." I presume he's talking about the hug that had been left.
Mm-hmm.
Leaving only that naked. It's quite a curious word to use to describe a hug, because it's not necessarily a naked hug. Leaving that naked, that gesture, that embrace.
Indeed, but he juxtaposes it with, doesn't the line after that describe his, that he's in his boxers?
I was left sprawled on the floor.
Yeah.
So he's sort of left naked as well.
Oh, nearly, yeah, yeah. And it's a curious juxtaposition because the you was wearing sweatpants. Where does the naked come from? Naked of context, naked of the world in which the hug occurred, naked of their history, naked of their separation, just a raw moment.
Yeah, I like that, a raw moment, which dreams quite often are a sort of a gathering, collection of raw moments in some way, aren't they?
Indeed, most of the time. I mean, you try to reconstruct a logic after the fact, but if you actually faithfully broke down everything that occurred in your dream, it would be a weird and random series of moments. Some of them very deeply meaningful, and some of them nonsensical, and some of them seeming random, like, where did I come up with this idea? Mm-hmm.
And we remember them almost as snapshots, as those raw moments. I'm thinking of your dream, you know, in this naked in the synagogue. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a series of raw moments. Literally, yeah. I'm thinking in terms of getting, you know, sort of chilled in
exactly
certain exposed places of the body.
Right. Another thing that strikes me is just the sheer minimalism in this story. I mean, he cuts all the context away of the dream. The context of the room. You don't get much of a description of the room. There's a bed. There's a gestronach that crawls under it. There's a floor. Everything else is minimal. You don't know where the windows are. You don't know what sort of light comes into the room. No.
But we don't really need to, though, do we?
That's what I love about Carrot's writing, is it's so focused. It's so... Everything in it is meaningful. Everything in it, there's nothing extraneous in it.